Hello, 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 mamas, and welcome to another episode of Angel Moms Hopes of Heaven, brought to you by Alana Song. My name is Angela Presley, and I am your host today. I would like to welcome today on the show Miss Stacy Davis. She's doing great and wonderful things in our community for our babies. And she's here to talk about her son, Cody, who I've heard and learned so much about. And she, Stacy, is definitely a fighter. And I so appreciate that she is a voice in our community. So Stacy, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I guess probably I'll start my story at the point that every mom that's lost their child probably remembers, and that's the phone call.
Yeah.
I got the phone call that night. It actually came from his best friend saying that I needed to get to State Bar because Cody was unconscious behind the bar. So based on that phone call, I had no idea what happened. But as I drove there, I somehow just knew that he was deceased. I didn't even have a clue. His friend's phone died, so he told me to get there and then hung up, and then I couldn't call him back. It kept going straight to voicemail. So I was trying to drive there as fast as I could. But when I got to the little hill that you go up as you come from, when you're on State, coming from like Lafayette and Spy Run, heading east, going into East State Village, there's a little bit of a hill, and I could see on the horizon just like lots of emergency lights. So I knew something bad happened. And when I got there, the police were very rude to me and wouldn't tell me if he was there, if it was him behind the building, anything. They wouldn't tell me if his friend was there who had called me and told me he was there. So I knew he was there somewhere, but they wouldn't tell me anything. I saw an ambulance leave the scene. So I followed the ambulance up to Parkview on Randalia and ran in there. They wouldn't tell me anything. All they could tell me was that it wasn't Cody in the ambulance. And then I saw the, but another ambulance had come from the same scene. There were two ambulances deployed, and it turns out neither of them had people in them. The perpetrator was taken by private car. And so anyway, I heard the helicopter start up on the roof and followed it out to Parkview Regional, thinking that maybe he was in the helicopter. And all they could tell me was that it wasn't him. So about that time, I get a call from a 449 number, and they said it was the detective and he was ready to talk to me. Where was I? And I said, I'm at Parkview Regional, but I was getting ready to head back to the scene. And they said, okay, that's a good place. He can just meet you there. So I knew. They didn't want to meet me at a hospital. I knew that he was deceased. So, I mean, I get to the scene, and the first person that gets out of the police car is the chaplain. And he said it was Cody and that he didn't make it. And I fell to my knees, and that guttural cry that I know so many moms have cried, that guttural cry. And it was surreal to me. The detective called me the next day and told me it was capital murder and we're going to get him and we know who it is. He's at the hospital. He might not make it. And to me, that was actually going to be kind of my justice, because Cody shot back. Cody was armed as well. Cody was a legal licensed carry. And he took his gun with him everywhere for these exact reasons.
Yes.
Now Cody wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. I mean, he was there to sell drugs. But people shouldn't be killed for selling drugs.
Yes.
Marijuana,
yes. For,
especially. But anyway, he was not living the right life that he should have been. But he was 22. He was still trying to figure life out. He hadn't figured it out yet.
Yes.
So anyway, the detective told me capital murder. We know who did it. He's in the hospital. I'll keep track of him. And don't you worry. We're going to get him. Mm-hmm. So as time went on, I kept in touch with the detective, and I thought he was doing what he was supposed to do, and that we were going to get justice. So he kept telling me that he was getting updates, and that the guy was he was going to live. He finally told me after about 3 or 4 weeks that he was going to live, but mm-hmm. he was going to be on a permanent trach and never leave the hospital, have to go to rehab hospital, and that's where he probably would live out the rest of his life, because mm-hmm. he was going to be on a trach tube and all that. So the first time I really got a hint that justice didn't work the way I thought it did, because I was under the impression that, you know, people do bad things and the police get them and they put them in jail, and that's the way it worked. Like, that's how it happened. Right. That's why I didn't commit criminal acts, because right. I was under the impression that when you do, you go to jail.
You go to jail.
So the first time I really got a hint that it wasn't going to work the way that I imagined it was one night I was out to dinner with a friend of mine, and telling her what all the detective had told me, that, you know, we're going to get him. And even if we don't get him through the court system, which he was confident that we would,
mm-hmm.
he was going to have his own karma, because he was going to be on a trach tube and in a rehab facility the rest of his life. And she was kind of quiet, but, you know, when you're just months into your grief, especially losing a child,
yeah,
you don't really, I didn't pick up on social cues. I was more very selfish, mm-hmm. not intentionally, but it was all I could do to breathe,
right?
Let alone pay attention to how other people are right. behaving around me.
Right.
So I didn't really pick up on it. But anyway, so we finished our dinner and went home. And about 11 o'clock that night, she called me and said, I can't let you believe the lies that they're telling you. And I said, what? Like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, he was my patient, and he is not in the hospital anymore, and he is not on a trach, and he walked out of the hospital on his own. Wow. Like, he's going to have problems the rest of his life. He lost part of his lung. He lost his whole, liver was shredded, which livers regenerate eventually anyway, but
mm-hmm.
He did lose part of his lung. And so he had ongoing medical problems, but not to the extent that he even needed to be in an acute care hospital, let alone a rehab hospital. And so I begged her to tell me his name. And she was very apprehensive, because she could have lost her job just for telling me what she had already told
yes.
me. And so she finally did tell me his name, and that was, like I said, 11, 12 o'clock at night. So I didn't sleep that whole night, of course. Mm-hmm. I researched him. In the first 5 minutes of just Google searching his name, I found out that he had a warrant in Allen County, which really kind of irritated me, because how did he get out of the hospital without the police knowing if he had a warrant?
Exactly.
Like, that didn't make sense to me.
Exactly.
So anyway, time goes. So I know who it is, and I can do the research, and found out a lot about him, like lots of stuff, mm-hmm. where he grew up, who raised him, where they lived, all that stuff. I mm-hmm. had a Google Earth of her house. Just everything that I could find out about him, I did. And now he's out of the hospital, and the detective clearly didn't know he was out of the hospital. So of course he didn't know where he was. And it took some time, but I found him and took some more time. And I got, so let's say, okay, so Cody got killed in December. So it was about February that he got out of the hospital. It was March when I found out that he had gotten out of the hospital. About May, the detective calls me and says, we got the DNA back from the gun. And I said, oh, great. So can we get a warrant?
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, no, we need his DNA to compare to the DNA on the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost fell off my chair because he had been in the hospital for 3 months. Why didn't they have his DNA? Like, it just seemed crazy to me. Like, I don't know. I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah.
I still don't know the answer to that question. So then I had to, they couldn't find him. I kept, would text the detective every week. You know, did you find him? So finally I had to put out my feelers and I found him. So they couldn't go get him on the arrest warrant unless they saw him personally go into the house that I knew he was in.
Yeah.
I was taking pictures of him coming and going, sending them to the detective. That wasn't good enough. They had to see him with his own, with their own eyes. So one night I get a call that from some of Cody's friends that mm-hmm. he's in a bar, one of our local bars.
Okay.
So I call the detective. He's in this bar, go get him. So one of my contacts lived right across the street from the bar. So they were watching for the police to pull up. They didn't pull up till like an hour later and he was already gone. It's so frustrating. So the next weekend I'm watching the bar. And sure enough, he goes in. So I didn't bother with the detective this time. I just called the warrants division and they were there in 10 minutes and got him. I called the detective and let him know that he's in custody. So go get his DNA.
Uh-huh.
And he says, I'm on vacation. I can't. Well, it was just a misdemeanor warrant. So I knew he was going to be out Monday as soon as he went to court. So, one of my aunts goes to church with another homicide detective. So she reaches out to him
uh-huh.
and out of the goodness of his heart, he goes in, gets the warrant signed and gets the DNA.
Oh, thank you.
It just was one thing after another. So then he, when they got the DNA, they interviewed him and he said he wasn't there. He didn't know anything. What are you talking about, blah blah blah. And they didn't have a warrant for the homicide case. In fact, it ended up being like 2.5 years later before we even got a warrant for the homicide case.
Mm-hmm.
And it was declined 3 times by the prosecutor's office in what I and many others call the Godfrey era, because Stephen Godfrey was the person that made the decisions on homicide cases, and he took very few. The solve rate for the period of time that he was the one making those decisions, each of those years is 50% or below.
Right.
So it was tough. And so unfortunately, my detective got a lot of the brunt of my anger and mm-hmm. frustration. And he finally told me, like, the only way you're going to get anything done in Cody's case is to get in the media and get political.
Okay.
And so that's when I started, like, reaching out, trying to find other homicide families. My ear, things falling out of my ear. That's when I found you. I found other moms. And as I talked to other families who had cases similar to mine, the things that I thought were anomalies, like not getting the DNA while he was in the hospital and not knowing that he got out of the hospital.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of stuff. As I talked to more families, I found that it wasn't an anomaly. That was the norm. Dropping the ball, things falling through the cracks, arresting people and letting them go because all of a sudden they didn't have enough evidence. Like, it was the norm. It wasn't an anomaly. It wasn't an extraordinary case. It was what was happening to every family that had a homicide case. So that was very frustrating to me. And as I reached out to more families, I first put together just kind of a little group of people. Leroy was one of us, and we went and met with a reporter from the New Sentinel, and did a story with him. And then we, soon after that, we became acquainted with another woman who had lost her son that was ready to get loud. She had held a meeting at the library and had the media there, and you know, we had our media contacts, and so we thought, you know, if we join up, that gives us even more people, more media contacts, and a louder voice. And so that group was called Flip the City, and it was very short-lived, but it was effective. We actually had a press conference where we demanded that the current prosecutor resign because she wasn't doing her job. And that really got her attention. We had a couple public meetings that were just calling out the what they called anomalies of the police department, what was happening, what, you know, these things that they were telling us, don't talk to other families, don't talk to the media, don't, you know, don't talk about your case, you know, all of this stuff. It wasn't to save the evidence for the case. It was to keep them from being held accountable.
Wow.
In my opinion.
Wow.
So, Flip the City was, like I said, it was short lived. And so Amy Davis and I were both part of Flip the City. And then when that group kind of fizzled, we knew we still wanted to do something. We still wanted to have public meetings. We still wanted to teach families what we had learned about how to navigate the system. I mean, I still every week get calls from moms or other family members that are like, our detective's not calling us back. Like, we can't get any information on the case. We don't know what's going on. Because it's intimidating to call the police department. It's intimidating to call your detective. And when they say, oh yeah, we're working on it, it's scary to question them further and to try to hold them accountable.
Right.
Especially if you think you're all alone, if you think that there's no one backing you up. So that's when JAVA was started. And JAVA stands for Justice, Accountability, and Victim Advocacy. And that's what we do. We talk on the phone for hours with families, with moms, especially just talking about the death itself, the justice, whatever part they want to talk about, wherever they are in their grief or their path to justice, I want to meet them there and then help guide them to move forward. Not move on, but move forward.
Yes.
So and JAVA is totally grassroots. I mean, we're all volunteers. None of us get paid. We started in 2018, and an interesting statistic, we started in our first meeting was in August of 2018. And as I told you, the solve rate for the Godfrey era, most of those years is 50% or less. Godfrey became a magistrate January 1st of 2019. They changed leadership. Gary Hamilton retired, and they moved Tim Hughes into leadership over the homicide detectives in November of 2018. So November in December of 2018, both the prosecutors and the police department made huge changes.
Okay.
So the solve rate for 2018 right now is just under 60%. For 2017, it was 48%, but they actually made an arrest for two homicides recently. So I bet that it's probably over 50% now for 2017. 2016 is hovering around 55%. The solve rate for 2019 is 85%. The solve rate for 2020 is just around 80%. This year, in 2023, we've had 10 homicides, and I think they've solved them all. Yes. There might be one that they haven't solved. And I'd have to check my records for that. But like in 2017, when I did my 1 year, I got Alyssa Ivinson to do, we did a balloon release at the site that Cody got killed on his angelversary. And I got Alyssa Ivinson to be there live on the 6 o'clock news. And for the story, she interviewed the chief of police. And he said that a 50% solve rate is about the best that they can probably do. Like the national average is 52%. So if we're at 50%, we're, you know, we're content with that solve rate. And she told him, like, that's a failing grade.
It
like
is.
50% is not acceptable. But he tried to convince us that 50% was a good solve rate. And that it wasn't physically possible to have higher than, you know, 50 or 60% solve rate. And they're in the 80% now. So they're like proving him wrong.
Yes.
Of what he said in 2016. So I would never like say that Java is 100% the reason that things changed. But I would never say it's a coincidence either that Java started in August of 2018 and 2019, things got better. I think that we have and still do have a influence on the way that the system works in some cases. We've had a case of a baby that got killed that the detective and the prosecutors had declined charges on because the mom just she had sent an email to the prosecutor's office saying that she just wanted to move on. Like, just don't even worry about what happened. Let's just close the case and move on. And that's what they did. So the family, her family, as a matter of fact, wasn't willing to let it lay. And they wanted justice for that baby. And so we helped them start a chalking campaign. But they did all the work. We went down there the first time and helped them understand where they could chalk and what not to chalk. Don't chalk on the building, just on the sidewalk, and, you know, don't use cuss words and, you know, that kind of thing. And we helped them do the whole sidewalk in front of the prosecutor's office the first night. Then that family then started going down there. Every time they rinsed it off, they'd go down there. So, the weekends, they usually didn't have to go down on Sunday. They'd go down on Saturday, but they didn't have to go on Sunday. But every weekday, they would have them have it rinsed off, and then the family would go down that night and re-chalk it. So after about 10 days of that, the local prosecutor called me and said, what do we need to do to make these people stop? Like, we know Java's involved with this, so tell me what we need to do. And I just said, they just want to meet with you. Give them your time.
Yes.
And hear what they have to say. And so they did. And they did end up filing charges. It wasn't a murder charge or even a high neglect charge, but it was a charge nonetheless. And he went to prison for a few years. And it wasn't enough, but it was the best that they could do given the circumstances. And just things like that. Like, we help families figure out how to get them to listen to them. And once they're listening to them and they're in the justice process, I go down and sit with them during hearings if they don't have anybody. I don't ever, ever want a mom to have to sit in that courtroom with their child's murderer by themselves. So that's kind of my mission as part of Java, is to make sure that that never happens. Victims assistance, that's, you know, part of their job is to be there, but they don't always know when a family is going to show up. If the family hasn't been in contact with the detective or the prosecutor's office, they don't know how to get a hold of them, that kind of stuff. So we have more families that reach out to us than probably reach out to victims assistance. As far as that kind of support. And as more families learn about us, obviously more families need us, because there's a huge gap. The system is not designed for the victims' families. It's designed for justice, and I get that. But it's so isolating and it's so frustrating to not understand what's going on and how do I, like I said, get a hold of my detective when he won't call me back. I went above his head. I found out who his lieutenant was. I called and left them a message. They didn't call me back. I found a sergeant. I went to the police chief. Yeah. I filed an internal affairs complaint. Like I did all of these things just because I wanted him to know who he was playing with. Yes. And I'm not letting this go and I'm not going away.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in the end, my detective and I had a great relationship. And I mean, he still tells people today, he doesn't think I like him, but I do like him. I think he did a good job. We got a prosecution. We got a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
We got 80 years. So Cody's killer is going to be in prison for probably the rest of his life.
Yeah.
But I had to do so much of the work, just pestering him and finding the killer and doing my surveillance mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, getting the warrant served so they could get his DNA, like just all of that stuff. But once Godfrey left in January of 2018, Tom Shaley is who took over at the prosecutor's office. And I think it was like August of 18. So we're going on the second Angelversary is coming up. And I had stopped calling the detective every week, probably 3 or 4 months before that.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to say I had given up hope, but I kind of had. I kind of had given up hope. I was tired. I didn't know that I was ever going to get justice the right way.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about how I get justice other ways. And I know a lot of families' minds go to that, especially if you have any contact with the streets, which, I mean, I didn't grow up in the streets or anything, but in my, you know, late teenage and young 20s, I was one of those spoiled brats who thought I knew everything and
mm-hmm.
and went to the streets and partied in the streets and
yeah.
went to my, you know, nice little house after I was done. I didn't live in the streets like a lot of the people that I knew did, but I knew a lot of people. I knew a lot of people, what, friends in low places, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had people offering to take care of it for me. And I kept telling them, I want justice the right way. I want justice the right way. Well, by August of 2018, I had kind of started thinking down that path. In fact, I in July of 2018, I had run into him at my gas station, the gas station that's like 6 blocks from my house, like
yes.
the gas station I go to every day. Like my gas station, like what is he, why is he allowed to be in my gas station?
Mm-hmm.
Like he has this whole city he can run around in, and he had two babies after he killed my son. He took those grandbabies away from me, and he had two babies while he was thinking he was getting away with killing my son. So anyway, I'm a licensed carry. I'm a 2A supporter. I uh-huh. usually have a gun in my car or on my person.
Yes.
So I came walking out of the gas station. He was walking in, and he smiled at me. And I don't know if he recognized me, but I sure did recognize him.
Uh-huh.
He had some traits, like he had a gap in his teeth, and he had a rat tail in his hair yeah. thing in the back and things. I mean, I memorized everything about him.
Mm-hmm.
Like I needed to know every single thing about him. I don't know if other moms, I do know some other moms that are like that, but I know others don't want to know anything.
Yeah.
But I was the one that needed to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew it was him. And so I got in my car and I got my gun out and I was waiting for him to walk out. And I was going to put his brains all over the front of that gas station.
Yeah.
And he walked out and I couldn't pull the trigger.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. The thing that stood out to me as I think back on that was his mom. Like, I could not do that to another mom. So, I mean, and I even knew that his mom didn't raise him. His grandma raised him. So I didn't even know what kind of relationship he had with his mom. But I know that having born a child from your body, when that child is deceased, it hurts you. It kills you. It devastates you, whether you've raised that child or not. So I just, that's the thing that stands out to me of why I couldn't pull the trigger, was that the first thing that popped in my head was his mom. And I couldn't do that to another mom. I was very disappointed in myself, because I had sworn up and down, if I saw him, I was going to kill him. And I couldn't do it. I let Cody down. I felt like I let Cody down that day. And I felt that way for a long time. I don't feel that way now. I realized that the way that the justice system works, that I would have been in prison and he would have been walking free on the streets if he lived. And I couldn't see myself in prison. Orange doesn't look very good on me. So I guess that I've reconciled that in my head, and no longer really criticize or am mad at myself for that. But anyway, so August of 2018, that event had happened. I knew now that in my heart, I couldn't cause him to be dead. But I had so many other people that were offering to me to take care of it.
Me too.
And I was starting to lean that way. And out of the blue, I get a call from Victims Assistance that the prosecutors want to meet with me. And I had already had three meetings with them where they declined the case. And my victim's advocate really was their advocate, because she was trying to help them explain to me why my points didn't matter and why my evidence that I collected wasn't good enough and why they couldn't go get him because I took pictures and showed him where he was. Like, she was trying to advocate for them to me, not for me to them. And so I just told her, like, if they want me to come in to tell me that they're not going to file charges, like, tell them, don't waste their time. Like, I don't have the time for a meeting like that. And I already know the answer. So why bother? And so she didn't even know what the meeting was about. She couldn't even tell me. And so she had to say, well, let me find out from them what it's about and I'll call you back. And so I reiterated, like, if they're just telling me they're declining the case, like, don't even bother. I'm not coming.
Right.
So she called me back and she said, I think you want to come. I can't tell you. It's top secret. I mean, like, I had to have FBI clearance to get in that room that day, I felt like. And my support person that I brought with me, they wouldn't let in. It was just me. And I was very untrusting. And felt like it was a setup. Like, why are you bringing me in here? Java had started. We had had our first meeting, and it was very uncomfortable. Like, I thought, what in the heck are they doing?
Right.
So they brought me back in the conference room and told me they had issued a warrant. It was a concealed warrant, and I couldn't tell anybody. Which, from the day that it took him 7 days to find him, and actually I found him. I did surveillance of the house that I had originally found him in, and they said he wasn't there. They had a CI that told them he wasn't there. So I had to start taking pictures of him again. One of the days that I was doing surveillance, I did see the U.S. Marshals drive by. So I could verify that they were looking for him.
Okay.
They didn't stop or do any kind of surveillance or anything. But I saw him there every day. And I kept telling the detective, he's there, he's there, he's there. Well, that Friday, the warrant was issued, I think, on a Tuesday. And that Friday, his car was gone, like gone, gone, like wasn't there all day.
Okay.
And so I told the detective, he's in Merrillville. Go get him in Merrillville.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, our CI says, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, quit listening to the CI.
Yeah.
Like, haven't I proven to you that I know what I'm talking about, and I'm not going to tell you something that I don't know for a fact to be true?
Right.
And he just kind of blew me off, and I got irritated, and I'm like, okay, so we're in another waiting game. in which I have no control over them doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so how long is this warrant going to be out? And how long is it going to take for them to find him? So the following week, I think it was on a Wednesday, the detective calls me and says, we got him. And oh my gosh, it makes me still emotional.
Yes. It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, I hoot and hollered. And I mean, my neighbors probably thought I was crazy. I was running up and down the driveway trying to find my guy and like tell him. And I called the detective back and I started to get him. And he said, I don't want to tell you. And I said, why? He said, because it was in Merrillville. I said, I told you, like, I knew where he was. I just knew it.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so they got him. And that was in August of 18. It took until December 5th of 19 to get the conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And we had three continuances. We had a mistrial with a hung jury. And that final trial in December of 19 that ended the day before Cody's angelversary just proved to me what everyone kept telling me. It was God's timing.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't my timing. Like, you are not going to say when this is going to happen. God's going to do it. And it's going to happen in his timing. And it's going to be the perfect timing. And honestly, it was, because, you know, that angelversary, when that comes around every year, that's tough.
Tough.
It's really, really tough.
Tough.
But God gave me that justice day the day before. So going forward from that day, that time on, it's kind of a bittersweet time of the year.
Yeah.
Because we got justice the day before we lost him, you know? So we can kind of celebrate both of those things at the same time. And it's not as heart-wrenching
yeah.
as it would be, I guess, without that justice.
Yeah, I remember that. I was so happy for you. I remember that. Yeah,
it was a long time coming. And I did so many media interviews. And I did so many just meetings. And I just...
Yeah.
I worked hard, and I did, like I said, I did a lot of the surveillance. I found him three different times so that we could get a warrant, so that it was a lot of work and a lot of fighting. But it wasn't very long into the process that they figured out not to mess with me, that I was not going away. You know, I'm college educated. I'm well spoken. The media called me, still to this day, they call me for interviews for, mm-hmm. you know, this topic, homicides. And it just, it helps me. I know I've heard you say this on all of your other previous podcasts, like, it helps me to help others.
Yes.
It helps me to stand alongside the new mom that just got these shoes. Because these shoes are ugly and they're hard to wear. They're hard to walk in until you learn how to walk in them.
Yes, yes, yes.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, I just, and along this path, I mean, I met another mom that has the same killer as you.
Mm.
I mean, she wanted justice for her son, and unfortunately, that you're the same guy that we suspect killed Alana,
mm-hmm.
Was involved with killing her son, and now has a warrant out of Alabama for killing somebody else. Like,
yeah,
if they had put him away for killing Alana, they probably would have saved at least two other people's yeah. lives.
Yeah,
and it's so frustrating.
Yeah, and who's to say even before Alana? Because this guy
right.
has been doing this a long time.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've found stories from when he was 15.
Yeah, yeah.
Involved in this kind of stuff. So
right.
This guy needs off the streets.
Even, you know, for Alana. So yeah, yeah. I get it. I totally get it. Just out of curiosity, because you were detective, detective, detective. When you finally got in your day in court with this human, did he kind of look at you like, I've seen her.
Oh,
I've
it was
seen
a
her.
whole thing. There was a whole section of the trial that he was trying to get charges dismissed or lowered. And the reason he gave was because I named him in the media. I was the president of Java, and which I'm not the president of Java. We don't like le officially have a president. We're all equal in Java. But yeah, it was a whole thing. Like he knew who I was once I started getting in the media, and he brought it up at trial, as an excuse for why he lied when they did the initial interview, which that was in 2017, and Java wasn't even formed then. But then also the reason that when they served the warrant, they questioned him again, of course. And at that point, he turned it around on Cody and said that he was just there to talk to Cody to sell Cody some drugs, but they were there just to discuss it because he used a self-defense defense, and part of the state law around that is you can't be engaged in criminal activity. So he couldn't say that he was there to steal the weed from Cody. He couldn't say he was there to sell weed to Cody. He couldn't say he was there to buy weed from Cody. So all he could say was he was there to talk about selling drugs to Cody. So that, and then when they brought that up at trial and that was a lie, that was his excuse because I was Java and I was in the media and I'm part of the police department and like all these things he brought up at trial that the prosecutor just kind of laughed at him about. But yeah, I mean, that was even part of their voir dire, when they were choosing the jury. One of the questions that the defense asked every juror was, did they know about Java? And so, and that was, I mean, Java start, like I said, started in August of 18. By the time we got to the first trial, it was September of 19. That trial was the Smith trial, and then we were rescheduled again for December. So Java had been in force for over a year by the time we went to the second trial. The first trial, he br even brought up things from the interview that I did with Alyssa Ivinson on the first Angelversary. So that would have been December of 17. He even brought up things from that interview that I said, because I said in that interview, like, I know who you are and you know who you are. So, I mean, he brought that up. So he had known me ever since I did that interview, potentially. So, but yeah, and it was difficult. And it's difficult for every family that I sit with the first time that you see that killer in the courtroom. It's tough. It's really tough. And sitting through trials are very, very hard. It changed my whole perspective on plea agreements because sometimes a plea agreement, if it's a respectable and justifiable plea agreement, 50, 60, 65 years, plead out to murder, but we'll drop the gun enhancement, you know, things like that are acceptable as far as I'm concerned. And it's up to every family what's acceptable. But it definitely changed my feelings on plea agreements because if a family can get, you know, that lifespan, 50 years, you know, if the killer is in their late 20s, early 30s, which is kind of the median age for these bad actors, a 50-year sentence is pretty much a life sentence. So if they feel comfortable with that, I often advise families to take the plea, to agree to the plea. And technically it doesn't matter. The prosecutors are going to do what they want to do anyway, whether the family agrees or not. So that's another thing that I often caution families, like, know what your bottom line is, but also know that they don't care what your bottom line is. They try to care, but if it doesn't work into their playbook, then they're going to do what they're going to do.
Exactly. I do know that firsthand. So I just want to let you know how much I appreciate you for being that strong voice for us
No.
mothers, because I am one of the mothers who, well, Alana's dad is more so upfront in the community.
Right.
I'm one of the mothers who can't really do that. I don't have that type of strength to see them and still keep my sanity. You
Right.
know, I didn't know names or faces because that's how I had to get through my day.
Exactly.
Yes, Alana's
Yeah,
dad
and I
was
mean,
all of that.
you and I being on together on this podcast are kind of like the each side of the coin. And each side is perfectly fine. It's exactly the side that you need to be on. Like there's moms like I said, there's moms like me that I wanted to be in that courtroom every time they even mentioned his name. I wanted to be at the prosecutor's office whenever they talked about the case. Like I did all the research. I wanted to know everything about him. What were his tattoos? What were his piercings? Like everything about him. But I have become friends and associated with so many moms that are from the other side of the coin too. And I completely get it. I get it. Like there were times through this process that I wished I was the mom that didn't, that could just put that in a box and let someone else deal with it. Because I mean, and I couldn't, but there were often times that I wished I could. And I totally respect the fact that you are finding your own path through your grief and finding ways to help moms in a different way. Like this podcast, I mean, like I sat and watched them all last weekend and had moments of tears and laughs and like I'm just like, Angela, this is so great. I love this.
Thank you. Thank you. We all, what I'm c coming to learn is we all are walking the same journey on different rabbit trails.
Yes.
Rabbit trails, but we're still walking the same journey. And
And
people,
still wearing these same ugly shoes.
same ugly shoes, same ugly vehicle that we do not want to drive, but we must. We must. So people that you can reach and touch, I can't. And mamas, I can reach and touch, you can't. And then
Right.
there's some we can together. So
Exactly.
we just all have the journey and this walk that we didn't choose and that we do not want. So if moms out there that are listening, or they're thinking, hey, she is the person I need. She's the person I need to go that step further. Where can you be reached? Tell us, mamas, where you can be reached, where you can be found.
We have a website and it's javafw.org. We're also on Facebook and it just put in hashtag JAVA. And then it should pop up with the parentheses, justice, accountability, and victim advocacy. Find us on Facebook, drop us a message there. We love for families to share their loved ones on our page, share their story. If you want to share their homicide story or just tell us a little about them. Like either way is fine with us. If you share, if a mom were to come on our page and share their homicide story, they're likely going to get a private message from a couple of the admins on the page. Like, tell us more. How can we help? You know, where are you
Wonderful.
at in the justice system? Like, have you gotten a warrant or an arrest? And then if they haven't, we help them, you know, organize chalking of the courthouse, chalking of the prosecutor's office, rallies, like press conferences we've helped families do. Just we just kind of like throw everything at the wall, throw all the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. And I mean, that's what I had to do in my path to justice. Like everything I could think of, I tried, and some things worked and some things didn't, but eventually I got there. And so, I mean, I encourage any family. And that's another thing. We started off just focusing on like literal homicides that were ruled homicides by the coroner that will have police investigations. But we also now support overdose families. In our view, an overdose is a homicide. It's a drug induced homicide. I mean, I guess there are probably are instances where the person chose to take that much drugs, but in most cases, they either didn't know they were taking so much, or in recent times, they didn't even know what they were taking.
Right.
Like fentanyl is in everything. So there's so many kids that died from fentanyl that is a literal homicide because they didn't even know they were getting getting fentanyl. So we have a huge outreach and support for overdose families, and then we also support families of missing persons. I'm sure that probably a lot of your viewers will have heard of Kevin Nugent. And we've supported their family since he went missing over 3 years ago. But along that path, walking alongside of them, we found out so much about the lack of investigation for missing persons and the lack of even acknowledging missing persons. Like probably on any given day, the Fort Wayne Police Department website is going to show like 6 people missing. NamUs shows like 13 or 14 missing from our area. But the Indiana State Police list typically 70 to 80 that are that are missing from Allen County. So we can, you know, nothing syncs up in that arena. There's very little investigation for adults, but even children, like the children that are missing they're often looked at by the police as a runaway, which sometimes they are, but they're still children and they're still in danger. So anyway, so we branched out to that. So we support families of missing persons and overdose awareness, overdose. And we do a lot of overdose awareness. In fact, coming up on May 6th, we will have the Appalled Rally at the courthouse. And then overdose awareness is in August. We celebrate all of the awareness days. So in September is homicide victim awareness. In February is missing persons awareness, and then in August is overdose awareness. And we do ribbons all down Clinton by the Martin Luther King Bridge, and then we also have the city light the bridge for 3 days during that time period. Usually it's like the day before, the day of, and the day after, if it fits into their schedule. So we're doing a lot of just trying to get awareness out there for these topics. Because before my son was killed, like I had no clue. I told you, like, I thought it was like Law and Order, you know, like they arrest them and then they're in court within an hour and then they go to jail by the time the show's over. You know, like I thought that's how it worked.
Yeah.
And it's not. So the more that we can keep the those that are in power aware that we're out here and we're paying attention, the better things seem to get.
Yes.
So that is our mission, and that's been my journey. So anybody that has any of those three subject areas, missing persons, overdose, or homicide, please find Java on Facebook. We specialize in Allen County. We know a lot of the players in Allen County, but we've even given advice to people in other counties and even other states. Like, you know, we don't know how it works there, but this is what we did here. And then they try it there and it works for them there. So it's
good. Good.
It's just common sense sometimes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. What a wonderful job. Wonderful job that you guys
Thank
are doing.
You. Thank you very much.
I personally thank you.
Thank you. We're going to get justice for Alana one day.
Yes.
I'm not sure what that looks like, but we're going to find him. He's going to be found.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In my prayers and in real time. Yes, yes, yes. So before I wrap this up, I'm going to ask you what I ask all the mamas before we say goodbye. And the question is, what is your hopes of heaven? Whatever that looks like to you, what is your hopes of heaven?
You know, Angela, I knew this question was coming, and I've thought long and hard about it because I struggled. At the beginning, I really struggled with knowing that Cody was there because he was selling drugs when he got killed.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know the last time he repented or prayed or, I mean, him and his brother both went to Ascension Lutheran School until they were in middle school. And then I just couldn't afford it anymore. So I had to put them in public school, but they had a base of religion. They know about Christ and they know about forgiveness. They know about all of those things, but he was an adult. I don't know the last time that he had a relationship with God or if he even did at that point. So I struggled with knowing where he is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes still now I do a little bit, but I've gotten signs from him. And there was a pastor that I hooked up with early on in my journey. And he told me that Cody was there. He had no doubt. And he told me that he believed that you get a chance after you die. You get a chance to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And I didn't believe him until I started doing some research and near-death experiences.
Yes.
And there's so many of those near-death experiences that got asked that exact question or put in a situation where they had to choose one path or the other. Mm-hmm. And I know once I started looking at it from that perspective, I know which path Cody chose. Mm-hmm. I know which path Cody chose. Yes. So I would have to say today, my hopes of heaven are that one day he's going to be meeting me at the gates.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got other kids here, so I can't go just yet. But when that day comes, he's going to be there.
Yes, 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 yes.
With all our pets. He's minding all our pets that we've lost over the years.
Definitely, definitely.
I also believe that he's up there bringing us mamas together.
Mm-hmm.
Every mom that has come to Java, I think it was her child up in heaven. Cody was recruiting them.
Yeah.
Cody's like, your mom is struggling. You need to get her to my mom because my mom will help her. And I think Alana's doing the same thing for you, mama.
Yes. Yes. That's what I need to hear to keep me going. That she's that they're rooting us on. They're rooting
exactly.
us on. Yeah. Yeah. All right, Stacy, this has been a wonderful time and it's always good
Thank
to see
you. Yes, you as well.
To see you. Yes.
You as well.
So I want to thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for letting me tell my story. It gets easier every time.
Yes.
And all those mamas that are scared to do the podcast, I'm telling you, it gets easier every time.
Yes.
Every time you tell your story, it gets a little bit easier to tell the story.
It's a little bit easier. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.